lawyers, and Mr. Hotz, who was an editor, we all had degrees in science. General Kutina had a degree from MIT. Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Covert, Mr. Rummel, and Mr. Sutter were all aeronautical engineers, while Ms. Ride, Mr. Walker, Mr. Whelan, and I were all physicists. Most of us seemed to have done some preliminary work on our own. We kept asking questions that were much more technical than some of the big cheeses were prepared for. When one of them couldn't answer a question, Mr. Rogers would reassure him that we understood he wasn't expecting such detailed questions, and that we were satisfied, for the time being at least, by the perpetual answer, "We'll get that information to you later." The main thing I learned at that meeting was how inefficient a public inquiry is. Most of the time, other people are asking questions you already know the answer to, or are not interested in, and you get so fogged out that you're hardly listening when important points are being passed over. What a contrast to JPL, where I had been filled with all sorts of information very fast. On Wednesday, we have a get-together at Mr. Rogers' office that takes 2 hours, and then we've got the rest of the day to do what? Nothing. And that night? Nothing. The next day, we have the public meeting. We'll get back to you on that, which equals nothing. Although it looked like we were doing something every day in Washington, we were, in reality, sitting around doing nothing most of the time. That night, I gave myself something to do. I wrote out the kinds of questions I thought we should ask during our investigation, and what topics we should study. My plan was to find out what the rest of the commission wanted to do, so we could divide up the work and get going. The next day, Friday, we had our first real meeting. By this time, we had an office. We met in the old executive office building, and there was even a guy there to transcribe every word we said. Mr. Rogers was delayed for some reason, so while we waited for him, General Kutina offered to tell us what an accident investigation is like. We thought that was a good idea, so he got up and explained to us how the Air Force had proceeded with its investigation of an unmanned Titan rocket which had failed. I was pleased to see that the system he described, what the questions were, and the way they went about finding the answers, was very much like what I had laid out the night before, except that it was much more methodical than I had envisioned. General Kutina warned us that sometimes it looks like the cause is obvious, but when you investigate more carefully, you have to change your mind. They had very few clues, and changed their minds 3 times in the case of the Titan. I'm all excited. I want to do this kind of investigation, and figure we can get started right away. All we have to do is decide who will do what. But Mr. Rogers, who came in partway through General Katina's presentation, says, "Yes, your investigation was a great success, General, but we won't be able to use your methods here, because we can't get as much information as you had." Perhaps Mr. Rogers, who is not a technical man, did not realize how patently false that was. The Titan, being an unmanned rocket, didn't have anywhere near the number of check gadgets the shuttle did. We had television pictures showing a flame coming out the side of a booster rocket a few seconds before the explosion. All we could see in General Katina's pictures of the Titan was a lousy dot in the sky, just a little tiny flash, and he was able to figure stuff out from that. Mr. Rogers says, "I have arranged for us to go to Florida next Thursday. We'll get a briefing there from NASA officials, and they'll take us on a tour of the Kennedy Space Center. I get this picture of the Tsarina coming to a Potemkin village. Everything is all arranged. They show us how the rocket looks and how they put it together. It's not the way to find out how things really are." Then Mr. Armstrong says, "We can't expect to do a technical investigation like General Kutina did." This bothered me a lot, because the only things I pictured myself doing were technical. I didn't know exactly what he meant. Perhaps he was saying that all the technical lab work would be done by NASA. I began suggesting things I could do. While I'm in the middle of my list, a secretary comes in with a letter for Mr. Rogers to sign. In the interim, when I've just been shut up and I'm waiting to come back, various other commission members offer to work with me. Then Mr. Rogers looks up again to continue the meeting, but he calls on somebody else, as if he's absent-minded and forgot I'd been interrupted. So I have to get the floor again, but when I start my stuff again, another accident happens. In fact, Mr. Rogers brought the meeting to a close while I was in midstream. He repeated his worry that we'll never really figure out what happened to the shuttle. This was extremely discouraging. It's hard to understand now, because NASA has been taking at least 2 years to put the shuttle back on track. But at the time, I thought it would be a matter of days. I went over to Mr. Rogers and said, "We're going to Florida next Thursday. That means we've got nothing to do for 5 days. What'll I do for 5 days?" "Well, what would you have done if you hadn't been on the commission?" "I was going to go to Boston to consult, but I canceled it in order to work 100%. "Well, why don't you go to Boston for the 5 days?" I couldn't take that. I thought, I'm dead already. The goddamn thing isn't working right. I went back to my hotel, devastated. Then I thought of Bill Graham, and I called him up. "Listen, Bill," I said, "you've got me into this. Now you've got to save me. I'm completely depressed. I can't stand it." He says, "What's the matter?" "I want to do something. I want to go around and talk to some engineers." He says, "Sure, why not? I'll arrange a trip for you. You can go wherever you want. You could go to Johnson, you could go to Marshall, or you could go to Kennedy." I thought I wouldn't go to Kennedy because it would look like I'm rushing to find out everything ahead of the others. Sally Ride worked at Johnson and had offered to work with me, so I said, "I'll go to Johnson." "Fine," he says. "I'll tell David Acheson. He's a personal friend of Rogers, and he's a friend of mine. I'm sure everything will be okay." Half an hour later, Acheson calls me. "I think it's a great idea," he says, "and I told Mr. Rogers so, but he says no. I just don't know why I can't convince him." Meanwhile, Graham thought of a compromise. I would stay in Washington, and he would get people to come to his office at NASA, right across the street from my hotel. I would get the kind of briefing I wanted, but I wouldn't be running around. Then Mr. Rogers calls me. He's against Graham's compromise. "We're all going to Florida next Thursday," he says. I say, "If the idea is that we sit and listen to briefings, it won't work with me. I can work much more efficiently if I talk to engineers directly. We have to proceed in an orderly manner. We've had several meetings by now, but we still haven't been assigned anything to do." Rogers says, "Well, do you want me to bother all the other commissioners and call a special meeting for Monday so we can make such assignments?" "Well, yes. I figured our job was to work, and we should be bothered. You know what I mean?" So he changes the subject, naturally. He says, "I understand you don't like the hotel you're in. Let me put you in a good hotel." "No, thank you. Everything is fine with my hotel." Pretty soon he tries again, so I say, "Mr. Rogers, my personal comfort is not what I'm concerned with. I'm trying to get to work. I want to do something." Finally, Rogers says it's okay to go across the street to talk to people at NASA. I was obviously quite a pain in the ass for Mr. Rogers. Later, Graham tried to explain it to me. Suppose you, as a technical person, were given the job as chairman of a committee to look into some legal question. Your commission is mostly lawyers, and one of them keeps saying, "I can work more effectively if I talk directly to other lawyers." I assume you'd want to get your bearings first, before letting anybody rush off investigating on his own. Much later, I appreciated that there were lots of problems which Mr. Rogers had to address. For example, any piece of information any of us received had to be entered into the record and made available to other commissioners. So a central library had to be set up. Things like that took time. On Saturday morning, I went to NASA. Graham brought in guys to tell me all about the shuttle. Although they were pretty high up in NASA, the guys were technical. The first guy told me all about the solid rocket boosters, the propellant, the motor, the whole thing except the seals. He said, "The seals expert will be here this afternoon." The next guy told me all about the engine. The basic operation was more or less straightforward. But then there were all kinds of controls, with backing and hauling from pipes, heating from this and that, with high-pressure hydrogen pushing a little propeller, which turns something else, which pumps oxygen through a vent valve, that kind of stuff. It was interesting, and I did my best to understand it. But after a while, I told the fella, "That's as much as I'm going to take now on the engine." "But there are many problems with the engines that you should hear about," he says. I was hot on the trail of the booster rocket, so I said, "I'll have to put off the main engines till later, when I have more time." Then a guy came in to tell me about the orbiter. I felt terrible, because he had come in on a Saturday to see me, and it didn't look like the orbiter had anything to do with the accident. I was having enough trouble understanding the rest of the shuttle. There's only a certain amount of information per cubic inch a brain can hold. So I let him tell me some of the stuff, but soon I had to tell him that it was getting too detailed. So we just had a pleasant conversation. In the afternoon, the seals expert came in. His name was Mr. Weeks, and gave me what amounted to a continuation of my JPL briefing, with still more details. There's putty and other things, but the ultimate seal is supposed to be two rubber rings called O-rings, which are approximately a quarter of an inch thick and lie on a circle 12 feet in diameter. That's something like 37 feet long. When the seals were originally designed by Morton Thiokol Company, it was expected that pressure from the burning propellant would squash the O-rings. But because the joint is stronger than the wall, it's 3 times thicker, the wall bows outward, causing the joint to bend a little, enough to lift the rubber O-rings off the seal area. Mr. Weeks told me this phenomenon is called joint rotation, and it was discovered very early, before they ever flew the shuttle. The pieces of rubber in the joints are called O-rings, but they're not used like normal O-rings are. In ordinary circumstances, such as sealing oil in the motor of an automobile, there are sliding parts and rotating shafts, but the gaps are always the same. An O-ring just sits there in a fixed position. But in the case of the shuttle, the gap expands as the pressure builds up in the rocket. And to maintain the seal, the rubber has to expand fast enough to close the gap, and during a launch, the gap opens in a fraction of a second. Thus, the resilience of the rubber became a very essential part of the design. When the Thiokol engineers were discovering these problems, they went to the Parker Seal Company, which manufactures the rubber, to ask for advice. The Parker Seal Company told Thiokol that O-rings are not meant to be used that way, so they could give no advice. Although it was known from nearly the beginning that the joint was not working as it was designed to, Thiokol kept struggling with the device. They made a number of makeshift improvements. One was to put shims in to keep the joint tight, but the joint still leaked. Mr. Weeks showed me pictures of leaks on previous flights, what the engineers call blow-by, a blackening behind an O-ring where hot gas leaked through, and what they called erosion, where an O-ring had burned a little bit. There was a chart showing all the flights, and how serious the blow-by and erosion were on each one. We went through the whole history up to the flight, 51L. I said, "Where does it say they were ever discussing the problem, how's it going along, or whether there's some progress?" The only place was in the flight readiness reviews. Between flights, there was no discussion of the seal's problem. We looked at the summary of the report. Everything was behind little bullets, as usual. The top line says, bullet. The lack of a good secondary seal in the field joint is most critical, and ways to reduce joint rotation should be incorporated as soon as possible to reduce criticality. And then, near the bottom, it says, bullet. Analysis of existing data indicates that it is safe to continue flying existing design as long as all joints are leak-checked, with a 200 PSIG stabilization. Note. Later in our investigation, we discovered it was this leak check which was a likely cause of the dangerous bubbles in the zinc chromate putty that I had heard about at JPL. End of note. I was struck by the contradiction. If it's most critical, how could it be safe to continue flying? What's the logic of this? Mr. Weeks says, "Yes, I see what you mean. Well, let's see. It says here, analysis of existing data." We went back through the report and found the analysis. It was some kind of computer model, with various assumptions that were not necessarily right. You know the dangers of computers. It's called GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. The analysis concluded that a little unpredictable leakage here and there could be tolerated, even though it wasn't part of the original design. If all the seals had leaked, it would have been obvious, even to NASA, that the problem was serious. But only a few of the seals leaked on only some of the flights. So NASA had developed a peculiar kind of attitude. If one of the seals leaks a little and the flight is successful, the problem isn't so serious. Try playing Russian roulette that way. You pull the trigger and the gun doesn't go off, so it must be safe to pull the trigger again. Mr. Weeks said there was a rumor that the history of the seals problem was being leaked to the newspapers. That bothered him a little bit, because it made NASA look like it was trying to keep things secret. I told him I was entirely satisfied with the people Graham had brought in to talk to me, and that since I had already heard about the seals problem at JPL, it wasn't any big deal. The next day, Sunday, Bill Graham took me with his family to the National Air and Space Museum. We had an early breakfast together, and then we went across the street to the museum. I was expecting to see big crowds there, but I had forgotten that Graham was such a big shot. We had the whole place to ourselves for a while. We did see Sally Ride there. She was in a display case, in an astronaut suit, holding a helmet and everything. The wax model looked exactly like her. At the museum, there was a special theater with a movie about NASA and its achievements. The movie was wonderful. I had not fully appreciated the enormous number of people who were working on the shuttle, and all the effort that had gone into making it. And you know how a movie is. They can make it dramatic. It was so dramatic that I almost began to cry. I could see that the accident was a terrible blow. To think that so many people were working so hard to make it go, and then it busts, made me even more determined to help straighten out the problem of the shuttle as quickly as possible, to get all those people back on track. After seeing this movie, I was very changed, from my semi-anti-NASA attitude to a very strong pro-NASA attitude. That afternoon, I got a telephone call from General Kutina. "Professor Feynman," he says, "I have some urgent news for you. Just a minute." I hear some military-type band music in the background. The music stops, and General Kutina says, "Excuse me, Professor. I'm at an Air Force band concert, and they just played the national anthem." I could picture him in his uniform, standing at attention while the band is playing the Star-Spangled Banner, saluting with one hand and holding the telephone with the other. "What's the news, General?" "Well, the first thing is, Rogers told me to tell you not to go over to NASA." I didn't pay any attention to that, because I had already gone over to NASA the day before. He continued, "The other thing is, we're going to have a special meeting tomorrow afternoon to hear from a guy whose story came out in the New York Times today." I laughed inside. "So, we're going to have a special meeting on Monday anyway." Then he says, "I was working on my carburetor this morning, and I was thinking, the shuttle took off when the temperature was 28 or 29 degrees. The coldest temperature previous to that was 53 degrees. You're a professor. What, sir, is the effect of cold on the O-rings?" "Oh," I said, "it makes them stiff." "Yes, of course." That's all he had to tell me. It was a clue for which I got a lot of credit later, but it was his observation. A professor of theoretical physics always has to be told what to look for. He just uses his knowledge to explain the observations of the experimenters. On Monday morning, General Kutina and I went over to Graham's office, and I asked him if he had any information on the effects of temperature on the O-rings. He didn't have it on hand, but said he would get it to us as soon as possible. Graham did, however, have some interesting photographs to show us. They showed a flame growing from the right-hand solid rocket booster a few seconds before the explosion. It was hard to tell exactly where the flame was coming out, but there was a model of the shuttle right there in the office. I put the model on the floor and walked around it until it looked exactly like the picture, in size and in orientation. I noticed that on each booster rocket there's a little hole, called the leak test port, where you can put pressure in to test the seals. It's between the two O-rings, so if it's not closed right, and if the first O-ring fails, the gas would go out through the hole, and it would be a catastrophe. It was just about where the flame was. Of course, it was still a question whether the flame was coming out of the leak test port, or a larger flame was coming out farther around, and we were seeing only the tip of it. That afternoon, we had our emergency closed meeting to hear from the guy whose story was in the New York Times. His name was Mr. Cook. He was in the budget department of NASA when he was asked to look into a possible seals problem and to estimate the costs needed to rectify it. By talking to the engineers, he found out that the seals had been a big problem for a long time, so he reported that it would cost so-and-so much to fix it, a lot of money. From the point of view of the press and some of the commissioners, Mr. Cook's story sounded like a big exposé, as if NASA was hiding the seals problem from us. I had to sit through this big, unnecessary excitement, wondering if every time there was an article in the newspaper, would we have to have a special meeting? We would never get anywhere that way. But later, during that same meeting, some very interesting things happened. First, we saw some pictures which showed puffs of smoke coming out of a field joint just after ignition, before the shuttle even got off the pad. The smoke was coming out of the same place, possibly the leak test port, where the flame appeared later. There wasn't much question now. It was all fitting together. Then something happened that was completely unexpected. An engineer from the Thiokol Company, a Mr. McDonald, wanted to tell us something. He had come to our meeting on his own, uninvited. Mr. McDonald reported that the Thiokol engineers had come to the conclusion that low temperatures had something to do with the seals problem, and they were very, very worried about it. On the night before the launch, during the flight readiness review, they told NASA the shuttle shouldn't fly if the temperature was below 53 degrees, the previous lowest temperature, and on that morning it was 29. Mr. McDonald said NASA was appalled by that statement. The man in charge of the meeting, a Mr. Malloy, argued that the evidence was incomplete. Some flights with erosion and blow-by had occurred at higher than 53 degrees, so Thiokol should reconsider its opposition to flying. Thiokol reversed itself, but McDonald refused to go along, saying, "If something goes wrong with this flight, I wouldn't want to stand up in front of a board of inquiry and say that I went ahead and told them to go ahead and fly this thing outside what it was qualified to." That was so astonishing that Mr. Rogers had to ask, "Did I understand you correctly that you said," and he repeated the story, and McDonald says, "Yes, sir." The whole commission was shocked, because this was the first time any of us had heard this story. Not only was there a failure in the seals, but there may have been a failure in management, too. Mr. Rogers decided that we should look carefully into Mr. McDonald's story and get more details before we made it public. But to keep the public informed, we would have an open meeting the following day, Tuesday, in which Mr. Cook would testify. I thought, this is going to be like an act. We're going to say the same things tomorrow as we did today, and we won't learn anything new. As we were leaving, Bill Graham came over with a stack of papers for me. "Geez, that's fast," I said. "I only asked you for the information this morning." Graham was always very cooperative. The paper on top says, "Professor Feynman of the Presidential Commission wants to know about the effects over time of temperature on the resiliency of the O-rings. It's a memorandum addressed to a subordinate." Under that memo was another memo. "Professor Feynman of the Presidential Commission wants to know," from that subordinate to his subordinate, and so on down the line. There's a paper with some numbers on it from the poor bastard at the bottom, and then there's a series of submission papers which explain that the answer is being sent up to the next level. So here's this stack of papers, just like a sandwich, and in the middle is the answer to the wrong question. The answer was, you squeeze the rubber for 2 hours at a certain temperature and pressure, and then see how long it takes to creep back. Over hours. I wanted to know how fast the rubber responds in milliseconds during a launch, so the information was of no use. I went back to my hotel. I'm feeling lousy, and I'm eating dinner. I look at the table, and there's a glass of ice water. I say to myself, damn it, I can find out about that rubber without having NASA send notes back and forth. I just have to try it. All I have to do is get a sample of the rubber. I think, I could do this tomorrow while we're all sitting around, listening to this Cook crap we heard today. We always get ice water in those meetings. That's something I can do to save time. Then I think, no, that would be gauche. But then I think of Luis Alvarez, the physicist. He's a guy I admire for his gutsiness and sense of humor. And I think, if Alvarez was on this commission, he would do it. And that's good enough for me. There are stories of physicists, great heroes, who have gotten information 1, 2, 3, just like that, where everybody else is trying to do it in a complicated way. For example, after ultraviolet rays and X-rays had been discovered, there was a new type called N-rays, discovered by André Blondel in France. It was hard to detect the N-rays. Other scientists had difficulty repeating Blondel's experiments. So someone asked the American physicist R.W. Wood to go to Blondel's laboratory. Blondel gave a public lecture and demonstration. N-rays were bent by aluminum, so he had all kinds of lenses lined up, followed by a big disc with an aluminum prism in the middle. As the aluminum prism slowly turned, the N-rays came up this way and bent that way, and Blondel's assistant reported their intensity, different numbers for different angles. N-rays were affected by light, so Blondel turned out the lights to make his readings more sensitive. His assistant continued to report their intensity. When the lights came back on, there's R.W. Wood in the front row, holding the prism high in the air, balanced on the tip of his fingers for all to see. So that was the end of the N-ray. I think, exactly. I've got to get a sample of the rubber. I call Bill Graham. It's impossible to get. It's kept somewhere down at Kennedy. But then Graham remembers that the model of the field joint we're going to use on our meeting tomorrow has two samples of the rubber in it. He says, we could meet in my office before the meeting and see if we can get the rubber out. The next morning, I get up early and go out in front of my hotel. It's 8 in the morning and it's snowing. I find a taxi and say to the driver, I'd like to go to a hardware store. A hardware store, sir? Yeah, I got to get some tools. Sir, there's no hardware stores around here. The Capitol is over there. The White House is over there. Wait a minute. I think I remember passing one the other day. He found the hardware store, and it turned out it didn't open till 8:30. It was about 8:15. So I waited outside in my suit coat and tie, a costume I had assumed since I came to Washington, in order to move among the natives without being too conspicuous. The suit coats that the natives wear inside their buildings, which are all well heated, are sufficient for walking from one building to another, or from a building to a taxi if the buildings are too far apart. All the taxis are heated. But the natives seem to have a strange fear of the cold. They put overcoats on top of their suit coats if they wish to step outside. I hadn't bought an overcoat yet, so I was still rather conspicuous standing outside the hardware store in the snow. At 8:30, I went in and bought a couple of screwdrivers, some pliers, and the smallest C-clamp I could find. Then I went to NASA. On the way to Graham's office, I thought maybe the clamp was too big. I didn't have much time, so I ran to the medical department of NASA. I knew where it was because I had been going there for blood tests ordered by my cardiologist, who was trying to treat me by telephone. I asked for a medical clamp like they put on tubes. They didn't have any, but the guy says, well, let's see if your C-clamp fits inside a glass. It fitted very easily. I went up to Graham's office. The rubber came out of the model easily with just a pair of pliers. So there I was with the rubber sample in my hand. Although I knew it would be more dramatic and honest to do the experiment for the first time in the public meeting, I did something that I'm a little bit ashamed of. I cheated. I couldn't resist. I tried it. So following the example of having a closed meeting before an open meeting, I discovered it worked before I did it in the open meeting. Then I put the rubber back into the model so Graham could take it to the meeting. I go to the meeting all ready, with pliers in one pocket and a C-clamp in the other. I sit down next to General Katina. At the previous meeting, there was ice water for everybody. This time, there's no ice water. I get up and go over to somebody who looks like he's in charge, and I say, I'd like a glass of ice water, please. He says, certainly, certainly. 5 minutes later, the guard closes the door, the meeting starts, and I haven't got my ice water. I gesture over to the guy I just talked to. He comes over and says, don't worry, it's coming. The meeting is going along, and now Mr. Malloy begins to tell us about the SEALs. Apparently NASA wants to tell us about the SEALs before Mr. Cook does. The model starts to go around, and each commissioner looks at it a little bit. Meanwhile, no ice water. Mr. Malloy explains how the SEALs are supposed to work. In the usual NASA way, he uses funny words and acronyms, and it's hard for anybody else to understand. In order to set things up while I'm waiting for the ice water, I start out, during a launch, there are vibrations which cause the rocket joints to move a little bit. Is that correct? That is correct, sir. And inside the joints, these so-called O-rings are supposed to expand to make a seal. Is that right? Yes, sir. In static conditions, they should be in direct contact with the tang and clevis and squeeze 20 thousandths of an inch. Note, the tang is the male part of the joint. The clevis is the female part. End of note. Why don't we take the O-rings out? Because then you would have hot gas expanding through the joint. Now, in order for the seal to work correctly, the O-rings must be made of rubber, not something like lead, which, when you squash it, it stays. Yes, sir. Now, if the O-ring weren't resilient for a second or two, would that be enough to be a very dangerous situation? Yes, sir. That led us right up to the question of cold temperature and the resilience of the rubber. I wanted to prove that Mr. Malloy must have known that temperature had an effect, although, according to Mr. McDonald, he claimed that the evidence was incomplete. but still no ice water. So I had to stop, and somebody else started asking questions. The model comes around to General Katina, and then to me. The clamp and pliers come out of my pocket. I take the model apart. I've got the O-ring pieces in my hand, but I still haven't got any ice water. I turn around again and signal the guy I've been bothering about it, and he signals back, "Don't worry, you'll get it." Pretty soon I see a young woman, way down in front, bringing in a tray with glasses on it. She gives a glass of ice water to Mr. Rogers. She gives a glass of ice water to Mr. Armstrong. She works her way back and forth along the rows of the dais, giving ice water to everybody. The poor woman had gotten everything together, jug, glasses, ice, tray, the whole thing, so that everybody could have ice water. So finally, when I get my ice water, I don't drink it. I squeeze the rubber in the C-clamp and put them in the glass of ice water. After a few minutes, I'm ready to show the results of my little experiment. I reach for the little button that activates my microphone. General Katina, who's caught on to what I'm doing, quickly leans over to me and says, "Co-pilot to pilot, not now." Pretty soon, I'm reaching for my microphone again. "Not now," he points in our briefing book, with all the charts and slides Mr. Malloy is going through, and says, "When he comes to this slide here, that's the right time to do it." Finally, Mr. Malloy comes to the place. I press the button for my microphone, and I say, "I took this rubber from the model and put it in a clamp in ice water for a while." I take the clamp out, hold it up in the air, and loosen it as I talk. I discovered that when you undo the clamp, the rubber doesn't spring back. In other words, for more than a few seconds, there is no resilience in this particular material when it is at a temperature of 32 degrees. I believe that has some significance for our problem. Before Mr. Malloy could say anything, Mr. Rogers says, "That is a matter we will consider, of course, at length in the session that we will hold on the weather. And I think it is an important point which I'm sure Mr. Malloy acknowledges and will comment on in a further session." During the lunch break, reporters came up to me and asked questions like, "Were you talking about the O-ring or the putty?" And, "Would you explain to us what an O-ring is exactly?" So I was rather depressed that I wasn't able to make my point. But that night, all the news shows caught on to the significance of the experiment, and the next day, the newspaper articles explained everything perfectly. Check 6. My cousin Frances educated me about the press. She had been the AP White House correspondent during the Nixon and Ford administrations, and was now working for CNN. Frances would tell me stories of guys running out back doors because they're afraid of the press. From her, I got the idea that the press isn't doing anything evil. The reporters are simply trying to help people know what's going on, and it doesn't do any harm to be courteous to them. I found out that they're really quite friendly if you give them a chance. So I wasn't afraid of the press, and I would always answer their questions. Reporters would explain to me that I could say, "Not for attribution," but I didn't want any hocus-pocus. I didn't want it to sound like I'm leaking something. So whenever I talked to the press, I was straight. As a result of this, my name was in the newspaper every day, all over the place. It seemed like I was always the one answering the reporters' questions. Often the rest of the commissioners would be anxious to go off to lunch, and I'd still be there answering questions. But I figured, what's the point of having a public meeting if you run away when they ask you what a word meant? When we'd finally get to our lunch, Mr. Rogers would remind us to be careful not to talk to the press. I would say something like, "Well, I was just telling them about the O-rings." He would say, "That's okay. You've been doing all right, Dr. Feynman. I have no problem with that." So I never did figure out exactly what he meant by not talking to the press. Being on the commission was rather tense work, so I enjoyed having dinner once in a while with Francis and Chuck, my sister's son, who was working for the Washington Post. Because Mr. Rogers kept talking about leaks, we made sure we never said a word about anything I was doing. If CNN needed to find out something from me, they'd have to send a different reporter. The same went for the Post. I told Mr. Rogers about my relatives working for the press. "We've agreed not to talk about my work. Do you think there's any problem?" He smiled and said, "It's perfectly all right. I have a cousin in the press, too. There's no problem at all." On Wednesday, the commission had nothing to do, so General Katina invited me over to the Pentagon to educate me on the relationship between the Air Force and NASA. It was the first time I had ever been in the Pentagon. There were all these guys in uniform who would take orders, not like in civilian life. He says to one of them, "I'd like to use the briefing room." "Yes, sir." "And we'll need to see slides, numbers such and such and so and so." "Yes, sir. Yes, sir." We've got all these guys working for us while General Katina gives me a big presentation in this special briefing room. The slides are shown from the back on a transparent wall. It was really fancy. General Katina would say things like, "Senator so-and-so is in NASA's pocket." And I would say, half joking, "Don't give me these side remarks, General. You're filling my head. But don't worry. I'll forget it all." I wanted to be naive. I'd find out what happened to the shuttle first. I'd worry about the big political pressures later. Somewhere in his presentation, General Katina observed that everybody on the commission has some weakness because of their connections. He, having worked very closely with NASA personnel in his former position as Air Force Space Shuttle Program Manager, finds it difficult, if not impossible, to drive home some of the tougher questions on NASA management. Sally Ride still has a job with NASA, so she can't just say everything she wants. Mr. Covert had worked on the engines and had been a consultant to NASA and so on. I said, "I'm associated with Caltech, but I don't consider that a weakness." "Well," he says, "that's right. You're invincible, as far as we can see. But in the Air Force, we have a rule. Check six." He explained. A guy is flying along, looking in all directions and feeling very safe. Another guy flies up behind him. At 6 o'clock, 12 o'clock is directly in front, and shoots. Most airplanes are shot down that way. Thinking that you're safe is very dangerous. Somewhere there's a weakness you've got to find. You must always check 6 o'clock. An underling comes in. There's some mumbling about somebody else needing the briefing room now. General Katina says, "Tell them I'll be finished in 10 minutes. "Yes, sir." Finally, we go out. There in the hall are 10 generals waiting to use the room. And I had been sitting in there, getting this personal briefing. I felt great. For the rest of the day, I wrote a letter home. I began to worry about check six when I described Mr. Rogers' reaction to my visiting Francis and Chuck. I wrote, "I was pleased by Rogers' reaction, but now as I write this, I have second thoughts. It was too easy. After he explicitly talked about the importance of no leaks, etc., at earlier meetings. Am I being set up? See, darling, Washington paranoia is setting in. I think it is possible that there are things in this somebody might be trying to keep me from finding out, and might try to discredit me if I get too close. So reluctantly I will have to not visit Francis and Chuck anymore. Well, I'll ask Fran first if that is too paranoid. Roger seems so agreeable and reassuring. It was so easy. Yet I am probably a thorn in his side. Tomorrow at 6:15, we go by special airplane, 2 planes, to Kennedy Space Center to be briefed. No doubt we shall wander about, being shown everything, gee whiz, but no time to get into technical details with anybody. Well, it won't work. If I am not satisfied by Friday, I will stay over Saturday and Sunday, or if they don't work then, Monday and Tuesday. I am determined to do the job of finding out what happened. Let the chips fall. My guess is that I will be allowed to do this, overwhelmed with data and details, so they have time to soften up dangerous witnesses, etc. But it won't work because, one, I do technical information exchange and understanding much faster than they imagine, and, two, I already smell certain rats that I will not forget, because I just love the smell of rats, for it is the spore of exciting adventure. I feel like a bull in a china shop. The best thing is to put the bull out to work on the plow. A better metaphor will be an ox in a china shop, because the china is the bull, of course. Note. The thing Feynman was going to break up was the baloney, the bull, about how good everything was at NASA. End of note. So, much as I would rather be home and doing something else, I am having a wonderful time. Love, Richard. The press was reporting rumors that NASA was under great political pressure to launch the shuttle. And there were various theories as to where the pressure was coming from. It was a great big world of mystery to me, with tremendous forces. I would investigate it all right, and if I protected myself, nothing would happen. But I had to watch out. Gumshoes. Finally, early on Thursday morning, we get to Florida. The original idea was that we would go around the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral and see everything on a guided tour. But because information was coming out in the newspapers so fast, we had a public meeting first. First, we saw some detailed pictures of the smoke coming out of the shuttle while it was still on the launch pad. There are cameras all over the place watching the launch, something like 100 of them. Where the smoke came out, there were 2 cameras looking straight at it, but both failed curiously. Nevertheless, from other cameras, we could see 4 or 5 puffs of black smoke coming out from a field joint. This smoke was not burning material. It was simply carbon and mucky stuff that was pushed out because of pressure inside the rocket. The puffs stopped after a few seconds. The seal got plugged up somehow, temporarily, only to break open again a minute later. There was some discussion about how much matter came out in the smoke. The puffs of smoke were about 6 feet long and a few feet thick. The amount of matter depends on how fine the particles are, and there could always be a big piece of glop inside the smoke cloud, so it's hard to judge. And because the pictures were taken from the side, it was possible there was more smoke farther around the rocket. To establish a minimum, I assumed a particle size that would produce as much smoke as possible out of a given amount of material. It came out surprisingly small, approximately 1 cubic inch. If you have a cubic inch of stuff, you can get that much smoke. We asked for pictures from other launches. We found out later that there had never been any puffs of smoke on any previous flights. We also heard about the low temperatures before the launch from a man named Charlie Stevenson, who was in charge of the ice crew. He said the temperature had gone down to 22 degrees during the night, but his crew got readings as low as 8 degrees at some places on the launch pad, and they couldn't understand why. During the lunch break, a reporter from a local TV station asked me what I thought about the low temperature readings. I said it seemed to me that the liquid hydrogen and oxygen had chilled the 22-degree air even further as it flowed down the big fuel tank onto the rocket booster. For some reason, the reporter thought I had just told him some important secret information, so he didn't use my name in his report that evening. Instead, he said, "This explanation comes from a Nobel Prize winner, so it must be right." In the afternoon, the telemetering people gave us all kinds of information on the last moments of the shuttle. Hundreds of things had been measured, all of which indicated that everything was working as well as it could under the circumstances. The pressure in the hydrogen tank suddenly fell a few seconds after the flame had been observed. The gyros, which steer the shuttle, were working perfectly, until one had to work harder than the other, because there were side forces from the flame shooting out of the side of the booster rocket. The main engines even shut themselves down when the hydrogen tank exploded, because there was a pressure drop in the fuel lines. That meeting lasted until 7:30 in the evening, so we postponed the tour until Friday and went straight to a dinner set up by Mr. Rogers. At the dinner, I happened to be seated next to Al Keel, who had joined the commission on Monday as its executive officer to help Mr. Rogers organize and run our work. He came to us from the White House, from something called the OMB, note, the Office of Management and Budget, end of note, and had a good reputation for doing a fine job at this and that. Mr. Rogers kept saying how lucky we were to get somebody with such high qualifications. One thing that impressed me, though, was that Dr. Keel had a Ph.D. in aerospace and had done some postdoc work at Berkeley. When he introduced himself on Monday, he joked that the last honest work he had done for a living was some aerodynamics work for the shuttle program 10 or 12 years ago. So I felt very comfortable with him. Well, I haven't been talking to Dr. Keel for more than 5 minutes when he tells me he's never been so insulted in his life, that he didn't take this job to be so insulted, and that he doesn't want to talk to me anymore. Now, I have a way of not remembering things when I do something dumb or annoying to people, so I forget what I said that put him out. Whatever it was, I thought I was joking, so I was very surprised by his reaction. I had undoubtedly said some boorish, brash, damn-fool thing, which I therefore can't remember. Then there was a rather tense period of 5 or 10 minutes, with me apologizing and trying to get a conversation going again. We finally got to talking again somewhat. We were not big friends, but at least there was peace. On Friday morning, we had another public meeting, this time to hear people from Thiokol and NASA talk about the night before the launch. Everything came out so slowly. The witness doesn't really want to tell you everything, so you have to get the answers out by asking exactly the right questions. Other guys on the commission were completely awake. Mr. Sutter, for instance. Exactly what were your quality criteria for acceptance under such-and-such and so-and-so? He'd ask specific questions like that, and it would turn out they didn't have any such criteria. Mr. Covert and Mr. Walker were the same way. Everybody was asking good questions, but I was fogged out most of the time, feeling a little bit behind. Then this business of thiacal changing its position came up. Mr. Rogers and Dr. Ride were asking two thiacal managers, Mr. Mason and Mr. Lund, how many people were against the launch, even at the last moment.
"We didn't poll everyone," says Mr. Mason.
"Was there a substantial number against the launch, or just one or two?"
"There were, I would say, probably five or six in engineering who at that point would have said it is not as conservative to go with that temperature, and we don't know. The issue was we didn't know for sure that it would work."
"So it was evenly divided?"
"That's a very estimated number."
It struck me that the thiacal managers were waffling. But I only knew how to ask simple-minded questions, so I said, "Could you tell me, sirs, the names of your four best SEALs experts, in order of ability?"
"Roger Boisjoli and Arnie Thompson are one and two. Then there's Jack Capp and, Jerry Burns."
I turned to Mr. Boisjoli, who was right there at the meeting.
"Mr. Boisjoli, were you in agreement that it was okay to fly?" He says, "No, I was not." I asked Mr. Thompson, who was also there. "No, I was not." I say, "Mr. Capp?" Mr. Lund says, "He is not here. I talked to him after the meeting, and he said, I would have made that decision, given the information we had."
"And the fourth man?"
"Jerry Burns. I don't know what his position was."
So I said, "Of the four, we have one don't know, one very likely yes, and the two who were mentioned right away as being the best SEAL experts, both said no." So this evenly split stuff was a lot of crap. The guys who knew the most about the SEALs, what were they saying? Late in the afternoon, we were shown around the Kennedy Space Center. It was interesting. It wasn't as bad as I had predicted. The other commissioners asked a lot of important questions. We didn't have time to see the booster rocket assembly, but near the end we were going to see the wreckage that had been recovered so far. I was pretty tired of this group stuff, so I excused myself from the rest of the tour. I ran down to Charlie Stevenson's place to see more pictures of the launch. I also found out more about the unusually low temperature readings. The guys were very cooperative and wanted me to work with them. I had been waiting for 10 days to run around in one of these places, and here I was at last. At dinner that night, I said to Mr. Rogers, "I was thinking of staying here over the weekend."
"Well, Dr. Feynman," he said, "I'd prefer you come back to Washington with us tonight. But, of course, you're free to do whatever you want."
"Well, then," I said, "I'll stay." On Saturday, I talked to the guy who had actually taken the temperature readings the morning of the launch, a nice fella named B.K. Davis. Next to each temperature, he had written the exact time he had measured it, and then took a picture of it. You could see large gaps between the times as he climbed up and down the big launch tower. He measured the temperature of the air, the rocket, the ground, the ice, and even a puddle of slush with antifreeze in it. He did a very complete job. NASA had a theoretical calculation of how the temperatures should vary around the launch pad. They should have been more uniform and higher. Somebody thought that heat radiating to the clear sky had something to do with it. But then someone else noticed that BK's reading for the slush was much lower than the photograph indicated. At 8 degrees, the slush, even with the antifreeze in it, should have been frozen solid. Then we looked at the device the ice crew used for measuring the temperatures. I got the instruction manual out and found that you're supposed to put the instrument out in the environment for at least 20 minutes before using it. Mr. Davis said he had taken it out of the box at 70 degrees and began making measurements right away. Therefore, we had to find out whether the errors were reproducible. In other words, could the circumstances be duplicated? On Monday, I called up the company that made the device and talked to one of their technical guys. "Hi, my name is Dick Feynman," I said. "I'm on the commission investigating the Challenger accident. I have some questions about your infrared scanning gun."
"May I call you right back?" he says.
"Sure."
After a little while, he calls me back. I'm sorry, but it's proprietary information. I can't discuss it with you. By this time, I realize what the real difficulty was. The company was scared green that we were going to blame the accident on their instrument. I said, "Sir, your scanning gun has nothing to do with the accident. It was used by the people here in a way that's contrary to the procedures in your instruction manual, and I'm trying to figure out if we can reproduce the errors and determine what the temperatures really were that morning. To do this, I need to know more about your instrument." The guy finally came around and became quite cooperative. With his help, I advised the ice crew guys on an experiment. They cooled a room down to about 40 degrees and put a big block of ice in it. With ice, you can be sure the surface temperature is 32 degrees. Then they brought in the scanning gun from a room which was 70 degrees inside and made measurements of the ice block every 30 seconds. They were able to measure how far off the instrument was as a function of time. Mr. Davis had written his measurements so carefully that it was very easy to fix all the numbers, and then, remarkably, the recalculated temperatures were close to what was expected according to the theoretical model. It looked very sensible. The next time I talked to a reporter, I straightened everything out about the temperatures, and informed him that the earlier theory expounded by the Nobel Prize winner was wrong. I wrote a report for the other commissioners on the temperature problem and sent it to Dr. Keel. Then I investigated something we were looking into as a possible contributing cause of the accident. When the booster rockets hit the ocean, they became out of round a little bit from the impact. At Kennedy, they're taken apart and the sections, four for each rocket, are sent by rail to Thiokol in Utah, where they are packed with new propellant. Then, they're put back on a train to Florida. During transport, the sections, which are hauled on their side, get squashed a little bit. The softish propellant is very heavy. The total amount of squashing is only a fraction of an inch. But when you put the rocket sections back together, a small gap is enough to let hot gases through. The O-rings are only a quarter of an inch thick and compressed only 0.02 inches. I thought I'd do some calculations. NASA gave me all the numbers on how far out of round the sections can get, so I tried to figure out how much the resulting squeeze was and where it was located. Maybe the minimum squeeze was where the leak occurred. The numbers were measurements taken along three diameters, every 60 degrees. But three matching diameters won't guarantee that things will fit. Six diameters, or any other number of diameters, won't do either. For example, you can make a figure something like a triangle with rounded corners, in which three diameters, 60 degrees apart, have the same length. I remembered seeing such a trick at a museum when I was a kid. There was a gear rack that moved back and forth perfectly smoothly, while underneath it were some non-circular, funny-looking, crazy-shaped gears turning on shafts that wobbled. It looked impossible, but the reason it worked was that the gears were shapes whose diameters were always the same. So the numbers NASA gave me were useless. During that weekend, just as I had predicted in my letter home, I kept getting notes from the commission headquarters in Washington. Check the temperature readings. Check the pictures. Check this. Check that. There was quite a list. But as the instructions came in, I had done most of them already. One note had to do with a mysterious piece of paper. Someone at Kennedy had reportedly written, "Let's go for it," while assembling one of the solid booster rockets. Such language appeared to show a certain recklessness. My mission, find that piece of paper. Well, by this time, I understood how much paper there was in NASA. I was sure it was a trick to make me get lost, so I did nothing about it. Instead, I pursued something surreptitiously. It was rumored that the reason NASA tried to make the shuttle fly on January 28th in spite of the cold was that the president was going to give his State of the Union address that night. According to the theory, the White House had it all cooked up so that during the State of the Union address, the teacher, Mrs. McAuliffe, would talk to the president and Congress from space. It was going to be great. The president would say, "Hello, how are you doing?" And she would say, "Fine," something very dramatic. Since it sounded logical, I began by supposing it was very likely possible. But was there any evidence? This kind of thing I didn't know how to investigate. I could only think of this. It's very hard to get through to the president. I also can't just call up an astronaut and talk to her, if she's in space. Therefore, switching the signals down from the shuttle over to the president while he's talking to Congress must be a complicated business. To find out whether anybody had set up to do that, I went down to the lowest levels and asked guys at the bottom some technical questions. They showed me the antennas. They told me about the frequencies. They showed me the big radio system and the computer system. They showed me all the ways they did things. I said, "If you had to send a transmission somewhere else, to Marshall, say, how would you do it?" They said, "Oh, we're just a relay station. Everything is automatically sent over to Houston, and they switch everything out from there. We don't do any switching here." So I didn't find any evidence, at least at Kennedy. But the guys there were so nice to me, and everything was so pleasant, that I feel bad. I don't like to cheat people. It was a little sneaky, what I was doing. Nevertheless, I thought I'd better do the same thing when I got to Houston. On Monday, Mr. Hotz came down to Florida to work with me. He told me later that he had been sent down with specific instructions to see what I was doing and to keep me from going wild. Mr. Hotz brought a list of things to look into. "There are a lot of things on this list," he said, "so I'd be happy to split the work with you." Some things, he said, he could do more easily, and the rest of the things I had already done, except for that piece of paper which said, "Let's go for it." Mr. Hotz hinted around that it might have come from the diary of someone in the booster rocket assembly. That wasn't enough of a clue for me. I just wasn't going to do it. Instead, I went to see a Mr. Lamberth, who had said he wanted to talk to me. Mr. Lamberth was way up in the works, a big cheese in charge of assembling the solid rocket boosters. He wanted to tell me about some problems he had. The workers used to have much better discipline, he explained, but nowadays they're not like they used to be. He gave me a couple of examples. The first incident had to do with taking the booster rockets apart after they had been recovered from the sea. The rocket sections are held together by 180 pins, each about an inch and a half in diameter and 2 inches long all the way around. There was some kind of procedure for taking sections apart, in which the workers were supposed to pull the rocket up a certain distance. They had gotten to paying attention only to the amount of force they were applying, about 11,000 pounds. That was a better method, from a physical standpoint, because the idea is to take the load off the pins. One time the force gauge wasn't working right. The workers kept putting more force on, wondering why they weren't reaching 11,000 pounds, when all of a sudden one of the pins broke. Mr. Lamberth reprimanded the workers for not following procedures. "It reminded me of when I tried to make things work better at my aunt's hotel. Your method is better than the regular way, but then you have a little accident." Note: the reference is to Feynman's method of slicing string beans, recounted in "Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman." End of note. The second story Mr. Lamberth told me had to do with putting the rocket sections together. The regular procedure was to stack one section on top of the other and match the upper section to the lower one. If a section needed to be reshaped a little bit, the procedure was to first pick up the section with a crane and let it hang sideways a few days. It's rather simple-minded. If they couldn't make a section round enough by the hanging method, there was another procedure. Use the rounding machine, a rod with a hydraulic press on one end and a nut on the other, and increase the pressure. Mr. Lamberth told me the pressure shouldn't exceed 1,200 pounds per square inch, PSI. One time, a section wasn't round enough at 1,200 PSI, so the workers took a wrench and began turning the nut on the other end. When they finally got the section round enough, the pressure was up to 1,350. This is another example of the lack of discipline among the workers, Mr. Lamberth said. I had wanted to talk with the assembly workers anyway. I love that kind of thing. So I arranged to see them the next day at 2:30 in the afternoon. At 2:30, I walk into this room, and there's a long table with 30 or 40 people. They're all sitting there with morose faces, very serious, ready to talk to the commissioner. I was terrified. I hadn't realized my terrible power. I could see they were worried. They must have been told I was investigating the errors they had made. So right away I said, "I had nothing to do, so I thought I'd come over and talk to the guys who put the rockets together. I didn't want everybody to stop working just because I want to find something out for my own curiosity. I only wanted to talk with the workers." Most of the people got up and left. 6 or 7 guys stayed. The crew who actually put the rocket sections together, their foreman, and some boss who was higher up in the system. Well, these guys were still a little bit scared. They didn't really want to open up. The first thing I think to say is, I have a question. When you measure the three diameters and all the diameters match, do the sections really fit together? It seems to me that